Welcome to Searching for the Question Live. My name is David Orban, and today we are going to have a conversation with Patry Friedman, co-founder and general partner of Pronomos Capital. It is the world's first venture fund investing in startup cities. And we will discuss Pronomos' vision for competitive governance, the work they are doing to build new charter cities, and how these could reshape the future of even entire countries, catalyzing a new wave of jurisdictional innovation and experimentation. So everyone, please welcome Patry Friedman.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So Patry, before we start talking about Pronomos, tell us a little bit about how did you get to where you are now? What inspired you to pursue this particular opportunity? Maybe even mentioning your grandfather, if relevant.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's the normal story of someone, an entrepreneur who wanted a product that didn't exist, and they figured other people wanted it and tried to make it. It's just that my product was like a country to live in that fit my values and was run like decently, you know, like a business. So I was looking for a place to live after college, and I'm a libertarian. And it was clear that, you know, the U.S. was not run according to my values. I mean, you know, one side wanted to go fight wars, you know, both sides wanted to lock people up for what plants they ate. Like, both sides wanted to tax a lot of money and waste it on things. Neither side could do financial arithmetic. Like, it was bad. And so I was like, well, maybe I'm just in the wrong country. And so I looked around the world, and I found there's a few jurisdictions that were really effectively run, but they didn't really fit my values. Places like Singapore or Dubai, you know, I mean, great jurisdictions, competent, but not really my kind of freedom-focused philosophy. And so, you know, you mentioned my dad's an economics professor and one of the main inventors of an alternative legal system known as anarcho-capitalism, which is the worst name because basically everybody either hates anarchism or hates capitalism. Polycentric law is probably better. And my grandfather Milton was, you know, a great proponent of freedom and analyzing rules and trying to come up with better laws that would fit people's goals and make economic sense. Things like vouchers, right? The government might subsidize something like education, but that doesn't mean that the government should operate it. We give people food stamps rather than having the government run the farms or the supermarkets. So this kind of history of, you know, how can we design effective rules? How can we design entirely new systems for generating rules was definitely on my mind. And I kind of concluded, coming from this both economic lens and as a software engineer, I spent 10 years at Google, that the issue was that we don't really have startups in government. There's no startup sector. The barrier to entry is really high, right? I can start a new website with a laptop, but to start a new country, I mean, we don't even know how to do that reproducibly.
Well, so there is this economic theory, and correct me if I am mispronouncing it, called Georgism, that looks at real estate, land, as the ultimate economic good. And, you know, a few hundred years ago, someone inspired by your views and subscribing to Georgism could say, great, let's conquer a new continent. And then as Europeans especially were known to do, make sure that no one would bother them while they were conquering, or anyone who tried would be killed, and then they would have new land. But in the 21st century, we have no land that is available outside of the boundaries of nation states, except Antarctica, even though some maps show you the pies of the various slices that the various nation states put claims on. Theoretically, Antarctica should be supranational. So how do you reconcile your desire of building new countries and the unavailability of the real estate to do so?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's why, I mean, I think part of what you're referring to is the nature of the frontier. And there's the Turner thesis, which thinks that part of what's different about America is that it was a frontier country for so long. And if you think about public choice economics, or just the common sense that power tends to entrench and protect itself. And so building out in new places that don't have those power structures already existing, you of course have a lot more latitude to try new things. And so frontier is really important. And that's why I actually started out my work in the 2000s on seasteading, on the idea of living on the ocean. Because like you say, all land is taken. And back in the 2000s, I think countries had not really realized that it's the 21st century yet, and they weren't open to these kinds of experiments. And so I spent years looking into the practicalities and promoting the idea of building on the ocean. And it was great at getting millions of people thinking about, hey, why can't we start new countries? What does it mean that we're out of frontier? But ultimately, the ocean is a really expensive and difficult environment. And I think there's some things, some projects that work there, but it's a really narrow subset of things that produce so much value that you can afford the costs. And starting with Paul Romer's TED Talk, or 2010 and 11 with the Honduras program, countries started to be open to this idea of trying out new laws, of having new jurisdictions on land. And the thing is about the frontier, it's not that it needs to be a physical frontier. It just needs to be a place where you get a blank canvas. And what's different about legal systems to something like sewers or electricity is it's a virtual layer. Like, what determines what laws are in a place? It's just some bits in a database. So in theory, we could be way more flexible. You know, a country can do what's happening with charter cities now, which is designate a region and say, in here, we're going to have really different laws, because there's nothing stopping them once their minds are open to it.
It is interesting. You cited a couple of fairly authoritarian places, Singapore and Dubai, as those that tried new things. But an even more authoritarian place tried even earlier something that became extremely successful, because to some degree Shanghai and Shenzhen are the original special economic zones that probably contributed to a very large degree in creating what is today's middle class in China, uplifting a lot of people out of poverty. And is it to some extent then natural to think that you need the stability and stubbornness of an authoritarian regime to have the courage to then say, okay, this little place here is something that we can experiment with. Does that mean that in the more chaotic, democratic, contradictory, pluralistic United States, it's harder to actually make that kind of decision?
Yeah, I mean, you bring up a really good point. And I think for people to understand this, they have to be willing to open their minds past the kind of first order models of like democracy, good, bad, authoritarian, good, bad, and just understand that these different systems have their own pros and cons, you know, whichever you prefer. And so as you point out, certainly, I mean, not just for what I'm doing, anything you want to do with a country is generally going to be a lot quicker and easier to do with a pretty top-down authoritarian country, because the person you have to convince is one person or a small number of people versus all the messy, you know, consensus making of politics. So it is easier. You know, at the same time, most of the time, the deals that an authoritarian state makes and the decisions that it makes are often not going to be in the interests of the broader people. So both are true. So I'd say that when an authoritarian government does choose to do something that's bold and good for its people, it's, you know, much more likely to be able to do something new. But it doesn't mean authoritarian's good, because they mostly don't do good things. China's this fascinating example where, on the one hand, all of that stuff was inspired by Hong Kong. It, for me, what's amazing about the Shenzhen example is it shows that a successful charter city can uplift an entire region, not just the people who live there, but it can inspire change and show a new way, and not in a small way. I mean, more people were lifted out of poverty than ever before in history in China when they liberalized, following the example of Hong Kong. But what Hong Kong itself, we had the somewhat democratic British Empire. And what was Hong Kong? It was a little authoritarian section where a democracy designated this one area as under this guy, John Capperthwaite, who had great freedom to set the regulations and the political system. And so it was a democracy choosing an authoritarian bubble that gave rise to one of the freest places in the world that not only enriched many, many people directly, but even more indirectly. So this stuff it's complicated. And the other thing you mentioned, stability, something that's tricky is that the countries that would probably most benefit from charter cities are often ones that have political turmoil or high levels of corruption. And so the places that would most benefit from this are often the places that are the most difficult to deal with, or where you can least kind of trust them to honor a deal. And that's the kind of double-edged sword, right? And that's why I look for countries where I feel that I can trust them. And we also use international agreements like the New York Convention, which can actually hold sovereigns to sticking to the terms of their deals.
Sovereigns are a very peculiar beast. They have very many ways that can either kill you or imprison you, and appealing to their sense of honor or trying to apply leverage is really hard, really hard. So what are the current structures that you are applying in order to implement this thinking? Tell me a bit about Pronomos, which is, I think, the latest vehicle.
Yeah, so Pronomos is the only investment fund focused on charter cities. And we've made 10 investments. Most of these projects are trying to do kind of normal charter cities on land. There's a couple they're doing other things. But the idea is that I've been thinking about and promoting these ideas for 20 years, and now countries are actually interested. And so we help connect founders to countries. We help founders understand kind of how to do this new weird thing, and we invest in them at a pre-seed and seed stage. And so we find ourselves working with teams and countries around the world trying to make more of these. So we've gone from zero to one with Honduras Prospera. We started operating in 2020, but we haven't yet gone from one to two. So the race is on to see who will be next to develop a charter city.
What are the kinds of degrees of freedom that you believe a charter city should prioritize most likely, contrasting with a lesser degree of freedom of the host country? Because the people who are following could have their fantasy running wild and just come up with crazy ideas, while you have the experience and the kind of recommendations or examples that you can give.
Yeah, I mean, the discipline on people's fantasies running wild is that these projects start on empty land. We're not changing the political system on top of anyone. And however wild your idea is, you have to convince investors to invest in it. You have to convince a country to enter into a public-private partnership with you. And you have to convince people to move there. And, you know, that's a high bar. So people who have, you know, just totally nonsensical ideas are never going to be able to do those things. And I don't know, if they do, then probably I'm wrong about whether it's nonsensical. So, you know, this is all about build it and we'll see what happens. So my long-term interest is in seeing really new systems tried. For example, the United States was really radical, you know, in the late 1700s. I mean, people in Europe called it the American experiment. They're really skeptical. It was kind of informed by the latest Enlightenment philosophy. And a lot of people thought it was crazy, but it worked so well that it's become the industry standard, you know, constitutional representative democracy. Doesn't seem to work everywhere, but it's kind of the best of breed right now. And so I want to find something that is as much better than constitutional representative democracy as it was than previous forms of government. But today, as we're just getting started, what makes the most sense in product market fit is just bringing the current kind of best laws from around the world into places that don't have them. I mean, I think a lot in terms of software metaphors. So when countries have kind of their own legal system, I kind of think of it like, what if every country, like, what if you only ran an operating system there that was written in that country, right? Like, you don't get to use Linux, you know, unless you're there with Linus Torvalds. And so I think there's a lot of countries that would have really great operating systems, but there's other countries, smaller countries with less exposure to technology, where the operating system would be really bad, right? Like, law is an information technology. And I think that we should be viewing it much more that way and copying and importing the best laws rather than having everybody write their own. It's actually sort of absurd to me, this idea of like a homegrown legal system. Sure, they should be modifying, right? They should be customizing it for themselves. And there may be some area of law where they're like, hey, in this area, we want something totally different. But the idea that like every country should be writing all of their law from scratch to me is kind of nuts. So if we just do what Honduras Prospera did, which is they get to write all their commercial law, you know, after having been approved by the government. And they looked at countries around the world and they tried to pick out, what do we think is the best mortgage law? What's the best labor law? What's the best family law? And put together a system composed of the best from around the world. Now, again, with the software metaphor, you can imagine that these different bodies of law are written to somewhat different kind of APIs because they're for these different legal systems. But as long as they're British common law based, you can imagine them sort of running on the same kernel to where you can do the work to reconcile with them, with each other, and make them fit together. So that's kind of what I recommend today. And I don't know, people, they often want to know, like, what's the one law you want to change? What's the most important one? And I don't look at it like that at all. I think that if you have laws that are streamlined and based on the best around the world and judged in honest courts versus homegrown laws where there may be corruption, it makes every aspect of every business better. You know, we're talking about kind of like degunking an entire engine, and of course it runs smoother. So it's not about any one legal change to me. It's much bigger than that.
It is interesting because Larry Lessig wrote a book called Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace in 1999.
I say law is code. I don't disagree that code is law, but my angle is that law is code.
That is exactly what I was about to say, because he wrote that code is law, and now you are articulating that law is code. Does it make sense to claim that it is more than an analogy? So, for example, there are certain parts of law that are very explicit and prescriptive and can and must be followed. So, for example, when you drive a car, there is very little gray area about the fact that you have to come to a complete halt at the stop sign, even though not everyone, you know, does that. And every other rule around how to drive and how to obey those laws. Or when you build a house, the fact that the electrical system and the sewage system has to be in a certain way is also explicitly prescribed. It would look like that other areas of the law are almost intentionally murky, because that is where a lot of haggling and a lot of additional separate value can be created by working out what is useful case by case. So how do you go beyond the analogy or beyond the metaphor if you want to create laws that can be explicitly interpreted, maybe even by machines?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, can look at one thing that that cryptocurrency networks are is financial regulation by code. My friend Balaji says that we should have unit tests for code. I mean, imagine that you have a city with a reasonable digital twin, and you could write the zoning laws in code that work with the digital twin, such that if you were proposing a change to the zoning law, you know, or if the twin had the level of detail of wiring and plumbing, a change to building codes, and then your system would tell you, like, what are the buildings that would be out of compliance if we made this change? Like, what unit tests break with this change? And for something like that, you know, you could absolutely do it. It depends on the area of law. There's some things where you can give computer code access to the underlying data to do something like unit tests. And there's other things where that really doesn't work. But I think moving in that direction, you know, thinking about the huge lawsuits over whether a comma meant this or that, or whether a comma was missing. If we had our laws more in code to where we could kind of run them and see what they said, even if a huge amount of human judgment is needed about the inputs, right? Even just having the laws like stated in an unambiguous grammar, you know, we get a lot of benefit. But I agree, it's a tight metaphor, not a loose one. You know, law is specified algorithmic decision-making procedures, right? I mean, that is a form of code, even if it's not as unambiguous as our current computer code. Just went on this software thing, I'm really excited about this week, is we've gotten the final go-ahead for one of my companies. The company is Metropolis, and the country is Palau. And we're doing something really exciting there, where we're creating an offshore corporate registry with Palau, where you can incorporate using the laws of other jurisdictions. So starting with Delaware. So incorporate a Delaware corporation in Palau. And what I mean is, this is not copying. You know, this is not like a fork where you copy the law, sort of like Dubai did with London financial regulation. They copied and modified it. They forked it. This is incorporating Delaware law by reference. Like, you're importing a software library, meaning as Delaware corporate law changes, as there's new legal precedents, that's the law that's used to adjudicate these Palau X corporations. And Delaware is just the beginning, where we plan to add other jurisdictions, Taiwan, Singapore, Caymans. And this lets you do a couple of things. One is, you can now incorporate outside the US and use the law that your attorney is most familiar with, where there's standard corporate documents, Delaware law, which is great. And you could even port from one place to another. For example, the Taiwan use case we're excited about is, if you're worried about the stability of Taiwan, you can take your Taiwan corporation and move its corporate jurisdiction to Palau, move your assets, bring over all of your corporate documents, all of your board resolutions. It's just like you're moving it to a different server that supports the same tech stack. And so I'm super excited about this possibility, because like, law is open source, meaning any law that's not a secret policy of some country is published openly. There's absolutely nothing stopping us from just using another country's law like a software library. And you know, for the programmers, when I look at this X Corporations bill that we're finalizing, you know, it specifies it's a wrapper, right? It specifies importing this, and it's like, everywhere it says Delaware Corporation, actually read it as meaning like Palau X Corporation dash Delaware format. And there's a bunch of little changes that's like, okay, in these few sections that govern, say, that the, you know, U.S. Constitution or U.S. Supreme Court will govern things, you know, we specify for Palau. So it just wraps it and makes a few modifications. It's like, I don't know, to me, it's like so juicy. It's like exactly treating it like treating law like code when it is, when it should be.
Very interesting and very flexible. And of course, these smaller jurisdictions need to be creative in order to find reasons for people to take them into consideration. Exactly. And the way that you describe this modular adoption of different bodies of corporate law, in the case of Delaware for Palau, is very, very interesting.
In small countries, they don't have, the thing is, they don't have economies of scale in many ways, but I think that there's diseconomies of scale in government. Like, that the larger government is, the poorer it makes decisions and the less risk it takes. And so in the 21st century, small countries are realizing that their sovereignty is a huge asset and that their size actually has advantages. They can be much more innovative. And so there's many countries, I mean, look at what Estonia has done with the e-governance, you know, or Palau or Honduras with the Zeta program. It's happening more that small countries can actually leapfrog because they're willing to try new things.
This January, I was at the first meeting in Kenya of Afropolitan, which is in Nigeria. And just sharing the website now on the screen, of Pronomus, I realized that Afropolitan is a portfolio company. So I'm very happy to see that as well. You mentioned Balaji, and maybe not everyone following us today knows that there is a conference coming up. I will be in Amsterdam next Monday, as we are now recording this, for the Network State Conference.
See you there.
All right. Very good. See you there. It is sold out. So people who didn't know will be able to follow the live stream of the event. They will miss out on the, you know, everything that is happening in a physical event, which we now enjoy so much after not being able to be together for some time. And a unique feature of the network state paradigm and concept is this very necessary and appropriate attachment to a physical place and physical boundaries. I would like to ask you to maybe explore in this second half of our conversation an alternative view that I articulated maybe 15 years ago in the Network Society Manifesto, which looks at how emerging technologies leading to decentralization, whether it is solar in energy, 3D printing in manufacturing, peer-to-peer learning, personalized health, and obviously Bitcoin and crypto in finance and payments, leads to an individual sovereignty and the ability of the individual to freely associate not only in physical proximity, but recognizing that unavoidably they will belong to a given nation through their citizenship and or through their residence, still build a new kind of belonging and participation that is non-geographical. And then it is up to that network to build value through services such that the individual belonging to that network society will start recognizing that, yeah, a lot of stuff is still local, but more and more is coming from that additional layer of abstraction. And as they build their lives, that becomes explicit to them. What is your opinion of this, given that more and more of additional wealth is created on the digital layer?
Yeah, I mean, this is this whole network state kind of philosophy that is kind of the latest iteration of the network society work that you're talking about, you know, which people kind of thought of in the early days of the internet. And I think it's right that the more of our economic activity and the more of our time and behavior go online, the more we're going to organize ourselves in different ways. So going back to my reasons why I think that the government industry doesn't work very well include that the barrier to entry to starting a country is very high, and also the cost of switching countries is really high. And so we just expect that an industry like that won't innovate. But online, the barrier to entry to starting new things is very low. The cost of switching is very low. And so it's naturally just much more competitive and much more innovative. And so as more of our lives appear online, we're going to have like new ways of organizing will evolve much more quickly. And like new ways are enabled, right? That being able to be a part, say, of a bunch of different groups where you reveal different parts of yourself to the different groups, having a mix of your real name and a long-term pseudonym and places where you're anonymous in a specific use case, like having your identity to being flexible like that and forming new social and new economic groups. I mean, you can look at cryptocurrency, right? Is it saying, let's have a group of people form an internal economy where they can issue, essentially issue currency or issue equity, depending on how you look at it, and organize their economic activity in a better way. I mean, that is living it. I think I don't have as much to say on this because my focus, one way to look at my focus is like, how can we bring that flexibility and innovation of the world of bits to the world of atoms? How can we have, you know, legal systems where you're like, hey, right now our zoning law is like imported this library 3.0, but you know, the country that originated it has been using their like 3.5 zoning codes for 2 years now, and we're ready to switch, right? And so you run the unit tests and you flip a bit and it's like, okay, this county now has upgraded from the 3.0 to 3.5 library zoning. So it's how can you bring those digital principles to applying them to the real world? That's my focus.
You mentioned the high cost of switching countries, and it is a bit frightening that the trend in the US especially, which is one of only two countries to apply universal taxation all over the world, is to almost kind of become as a feudal system. It has become longer, harder, and more expensive to apply the choice, which should be available to anyone, to renounce their US citizenship, to the point where now maybe 90% of the people, if they wanted to look at the option, it would be beyond their reach. And so it has become a bit of I don't want to exaggerate, of course.
I don't agree here. I do think it's terrible that the US taxes people wherever they live and work, and is one of the only countries to do that. I guess you can think of it as like they have this luxury product, you know, this incredible citizenship, and they charge for it. But I don't like it. But actually, the laws for renouncing, and again, it's like you're not allowed to renounce if your goal is taxes. And that's, I feel like it's none of their business. But what's changed is, I think this was like maybe even the Patriot Act, but it used to be that if you renounced, you had to keep paying taxes for 10 years. And they actually changed it in the early 2000s to being, you pay a one-time tax as if you'd exited everything. So all of your accumulated capital gains, you know, whatever businesses you own that you haven't paid tax on, that you would have to pay tax on someday, you pay this one-time tax on the value that you created in the jurisdiction, and you're done. And I actually think that's a much better system, even though this, you know, wouldn't be necessary at all if they didn't have this nonsense of, you know, kind of claiming you like a slave, like wherever you live and work, like we get your money, which is, you know, is very odd, but I think they'll get outcompeted. And then that's what will change that.
Yeah, I when I said I didn't want to exaggerate, I was about to use a weaker term, a vassal, a feudal vassal, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
So what are the ultimate goals of your vision? How flexibly, for example, what is the minimum viable product of a charter city in terms of population, in your opinion, in order for it to make sense? And as a consequence, real estate investment in acquiring the land and building the buildings. And then after we define this minimum viable product, where is product market fit so that it can accelerate and create thousands of them or maybe tens of thousands all over the world?
Yeah, in terms of goals, the goal is human flourishing, and specifically human flourishing through improving how we organize and coordinate ourselves, especially with the set of things that we now call government. And, you know, my life mission metrics includes things like what percentage of world population and world GDP lives under kind of modern style legal systems. And so I want it to scale enormously. And then I think that to do this, we're going to want, you know, a combination of startup sovereign city states, where the minimum viable product is much larger, and we won't be able to do that until we've proven ourselves and have more capital and more experience and more respect. And these charter cities and other projects where within an existing country, a given area gets to have different laws. And then maybe if things work out well, that's brought to other areas of the country where we have the law be just much more flexible. We treat it much more like code, where instead of having the vast majority of laws in the US at the federal level, that there's more laws that are set down locally so you can have more diversity and more experimentation, where we change legal systems more often, you know, not too often. Like, you know, you don't swap out the code that runs a hospital, you know, really often because you don't want people to die. But we can certainly do it more than we do. And like I said, going from a 3.0 zoning library to someone's 3.5 zoning library, like that's not that big a change. And we ought to be able to get comfortable with doing it and just have a much more modular, you know, kind of composed legal systems with far fewer homegrown laws and more standardization, where if you want to do a completely different medical regulations, it's not just because like, oh, we're a country, we got to write it ourselves. It's like, okay, we've decided that we really want to attract a certain medical industry, that we have the expertise to actually write this library in a new way, and we're going to lead it. Where the default decision, you know, the default decision when, you know, is not to write your own operating system, right? That's not the default decision. You take what works and you fix what doesn't, and you have the time to. So that's the role that I want to see. In terms of minimum viable product, I think best is to look at Honduras Prospera. Now there, they have the advantage that the country created the program first. So with almost all of our other companies, we're going to countries that are interested in working with them to create these programs. Whereas Honduras actually created this before there were any companies. But Prospera was able to do their first beta building with less than $10 million of funding, maybe less than $5 million of funding. And at this point, they've raised something like $120 million. And they have hundreds of acres, three different sites, and about 100 people live there right now. And they have another 100 apartments opening in the coming months. So that's going to go up by several times. About 500 people work there in person every week. But they started out with one building, right? And I think, you know, if you're a seastead, imagine a floating city state, fully sovereign out in the middle of nowhere. The minimum for that is huge, right? You don't have existing infrastructure to depend on. I mean, tens of billions, like maybe tens of billions. It could be more because it's in the middle of nowhere without existing infrastructure and, you know, also without existing government infrastructure. But if you look at something like, you know, a medical center in Palau or Prospera in Honduras, something, or our company Etana that's building in Nigeria, when it has an existing country, the existing country has the treaties and it has the military. A lot of stuff is done at that level. And there's all the existing infrastructure. You're not having to build your own airport. You may or may not do your own power. So the minimum viable product, it gets a lot smaller. And there's no reason in theory why your zone can't start out with one building as Prospera did and grow from there, as long as it's embedded in an economy and has access to other people, other jobs, and other infrastructure.
We have a viewer asking, he's watching from Saudi Arabia. What do you think of NEOM?
I'm really skeptical about how top down it is. I guess there's two things. One is you need to have some amount of top down for any startup. I mean, you know, often these charter cities aim to be master planned at the beginning, but you start out master planned, and then it has to get more and more bottom up because you don't know what businesses are going to come in. You don't know where people are going to want to live. And I don't think that you create kind of like sustainable patterns of specialization and trade, which is what Arnold Kling calls an economy, by dictating it top down. And related is the issue of subsidization. So for me, this comes from Jane Jacob, who pointed out how some of the New Deal projects in the U.S., which was an example of a city that that is highly subsidized from some nearby project that would not actually exist otherwise. And these places die when the subsidy is removed. It's because the people and the skills and the jobs and companies that will actually be able to produce long-term value going forward are not going to be the ones that you just know and pick ahead of time. It's actually very, very hard to subsidize an economy that can survive without the subsidies. It's a really hard problem. And I'm not saying it's impossible. I think that if you strike a balance, for example, what if you subsidize by building really good infrastructure, but not trying to dictate the industries or exactly where people build or what they do, but you put in great infrastructure and then grow a town around that. So I think that there's ways of creating economies by subsidy, but it's really hard. I think people don't realize how hard. David, like what's a good metaphor for this, where like you think you can prop something up, but actually when you're propping it up, I don't know, maybe it's like a baby. If a baby needs to learn to walk, if you never let a baby walk or crawl, if you just carry it everywhere, it's never going to develop like muscles or coordination.
Barn raising without the nails, where people have to stay there and just keep the barn. And if they leave, it falls apart. So the people following what you are doing can get excited, and unfortunately current regulations are such that if they want to be part of Pronomos in some way, for example backing your fund, we are not even allowed to tell them if you are raising a new fund, which I believe is a horribly elitist and creating artificial scarcity in and barriers to participation that should be renewed or reformed. But even more modest reforms like the equity crowdfunding in the US have been neutered by an excessive amount of regulation. So aside that, people can go to pronomos.vc. What other things recommend they keep an eye on as they are interested in following what you do?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I'd say go to pronomos.vc, and we've got our various social channels there. That's a great way to follow on. We're going to be putting out a ton more content starting early next year. And the other is on our website, you'll see a portfolio page. It's one of the links at the top, pronomos.vc/portfolio. And there we've collected all of the socials of all of our public portfolio companies, which is 8 out of 10 of them. And so that's just an incredible way to keep up with the space. I mean, the Prospera Instagram is amazing. It makes me so happy to see, because right, I've been pitching this stuff for over 20 years when it was just an idea, or maybe I had some pictures of Dubai or some renderings of a seastead. And now you can follow the Prospera Instagram and see like videos of an actually operating charter city coming out day after day. It's so exciting. So I'd say that's the best way to track the space, is follow us and follow our portfolio.
Wonderful. So Patry, thank you very much. As we just found out, see you in Amsterdam next Monday.
Yep. Look forward to seeing you then.
All right. Thank you very much for being with us, and looking forward to continuing our conversations, both on searching for the question live as well as in our physical meetings. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you everyone for participating in this episode of Searching for the Question Live. See you next time with a new guest.